This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Hurricane Dorian continues to crawl up the U.S. eastern coast, drenching the Carolinas with rain as people in the Bahamas continue to assess damage and make a plan for recovery there. The death toll in the Bahamas now stands at more than 30, and officials say they have no doubt that the number will rise. The U.S. Coast Guard and British Royal Navy have ships docked off the islands, and the United Nations is sending emergency food rations and communications equipment. AP correspondent Michael Weissenstein reports that not much aid has arrived yet.
We're starting to see helicopters and some Bahamian Defense Force Marines in the street and a few police, but so far there's really not a feeling of a lot of aid coming. I think it may be starting today, but people up till now, 5-6 days later, have just been surviving on what was on the island when the hurricane hit.
And the Bahamas Prime Minister, Hubert Minnis, pledges to do whatever is necessary to carry out rescue and recovery efforts. U.S. President Donald Trump has sent the Coast Guard and urban search and rescue teams to help. The man responsible for the Trump administration's Mideast peace plan is leaving the White House, AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani.
The White House says the peace plan is done, but will not be released until after this month's Israeli elections. There is now more doubt about its future, with the administration saying Jason Greenblatt will leave in the coming weeks. Palestinians have already rejected the plan, saying it boosts ties between the U.S. and Israel. Greenblatt also infuriated Palestinian leaders by pushing for moving the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and recognizing Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's spokesman says Greenblatt ruined American credibility and destroyed the peace process. Sagar Magani at the White House.
And this is VOA News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson suffered yet another blow Thursday when his brother announced his resignation as a junior minister and from Parliament. This comes after another setback for the Prime Minister, and that is the House of Commons voting in favor of a measure forcing the government to ask the EU to delay Brexit another 3 months if there is no exit deal by October 31st deadline. The measure now goes to Parliament's upper chamber, the House of Lords. Meanwhile, the news has sent the British pound back up after an early week low. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma.
Britain's currency took a hammering early this week, falling below $1.20 to the pound, its lowest since 1985, excluding a brief two-minute crash in 2016. Investors were concerned that Prime Minister Boris Johnson would be able to suspend Parliament and bring the country out of the EU with or without a deal. A no-deal exit is widely considered a worst-case scenario for business, but the pound has rallied as British lawmakers this week wrested control over the Brexit timetable away from Johnson. A bill blocking a no-deal Brexit is on course to pass into law before Parliament is suspended next week. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Mozambique gave a warm and colourful welcome to Pope Francis as he toured the capital Thursday and spoke to lawmakers, youth and clergy. VOA's Anita Powell reports.
Thousands of young Catholics packed a Maputo Stadium to hear him speak of hope, peace and reconciliation to a nation that, for decades, has struggled with conflict. He was greeted Wednesday night by President Filipe Nyusi, who is running for re-election in October in a contentious poll in which rival parties have already begun heavy mudslinging at each other. But the pontiff did not pander to Mozambique's leadership when pointing out their higher responsibility to honor a recent peace deal. As we know, he says, peace is not merely absence of war, but a tireless commitment, especially on the part of those of us charged with greater responsibility, to recognize, protect, and concretely restore the dignity, so often overlooked or ignored, of our brothers and sisters. Anita Powell, VOA News, Maputo.
Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam says the decision to withdraw a controversial extradition bill in the semi-autonomous Chinese territory was her government's own initiative to break the impasse. It is not Beijing's directive. Withdrawal of the bill means it meets one of the protesters' 5 key demands. Those demands also include an independent investigation into allegations of police brutality during the protest. Find more at voanews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 6th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria vows protection for lives and property in the wake of xenophobic attacks in South Africa.
I assured everybody in Nigeria, foreigners, many other rights, that the federal government will provide adequate security to ensure that life and property are secure.
Lai Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister. Is drug trafficking used to finance jihadist groups in the Sahel? East Africa Healthcare Federation holds a conference in Nairobi. Cameroon villagers say Chinese gold miners are ruining their environment. And Sudan's new prime minister unveils his much-awaited cabinet.
The cabinet is a technocrat, experienced, representing a majority of Sudanese. For instance, there is representation of the women, there is representation for youth, and also there is diversity represented in the cabinet.
That's reported by Muhyiddin in Khartoum, and wildlife activists call for global intervention to save world primates. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Nigeria's information minister says President Muhammadu Buhari's government will protect all lives and property in the wake of this week's xenophobic attacks on other Africans in South Africa. Lai Mohammed says no Nigerian was killed in the latest xenophobic attacks. Meanwhile, South Africa temporarily closed its embassy in Nigeria on Thursday to protect against reprisal attacks. The information minister has warned Nigerians against the distribution of fake videos about alleged xenophobic attacks on Nigerians in South Africa. Lai Mohammed says such videos are intended to provoke possible revenge attacks.
Well, I think it is a fake video, and we have identified three of them. One of them is a video that shows a man who has been set ablaze trying to escape. And we both circulating the video, identified the man as a Nigerian. It is not true. This particular video is about a Mozambican that was set ablaze in 2008. So what we are saying is that it is a deliberate attempt by some naysayers and some Sikh colonies to actually inflame passion. We have the words of our High Commissioner, but not one single Nigeria was killed in the latest xenophobic attack. So that's what we want to please be careful of these videos. Some of them are actually being sent to inflame passion.
So will the government ensure that those who are spreading such false information be warned or be punished?
That's why at my press conference today, I want Nigerians to be really on the careful of this kind of fake news and fake videos. Because it's the first time it's not been the Nigerians who are behind this. I mean, any Sikh colony could be actually want to aggravate the point between South Africa and Nigeria. I could very well have done that. That is why we actually want to against this kind of fake videos.
We understand the president has sent a special envoy to South Africa after recalling the High Commissioner there. What is the current relationship between Abuja and Pretoria, if I may ask you?
The Nigerian High Commissioner in South Africa has not been called. But he will come home for consultation after the special envoy has met with the South African president. That is the practice in the present cycle. So if the airport will only be recalled home for consultation, and they will now sit down and review with the president and the special envoy exactly the response of South Africa. But I don't know the status of the envoy. I cannot say to my colleagues, so I'm not my colleagues, but I know an envoy has been sent to the South African president.
The Nigerian Student Association also issued an ultimatum for South African businesses. What is your response to their ultimatum, and what is the government going to do about this?
I did at my conference this morning. I assured everybody in Nigeria, foreigners, many other rights, that the federal government will provide adequate security to ensure that life and property are secured. And foreigners, whether they are South Africa or whoever, should please rest assured that the federal government is going to provide adequate security. We want to reassure Nigerians that the federal government will protect the interests of Nigerians anywhere in the world.
Lyle Mohammed is Nigeria's information minister. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. Sudan's new prime minister, Abdallah Hamdok, late Thursday unveiled 18 members of his much-awaited cabinet. It is the first step in the country's transition from almost 30 years under the rule of former President Omar al-Bashir. Reporter Naba Mohideen in Khartoum says the cabinet represents the new Sudan as it includes women, youth, and technocrats.
The cabinet is a technocrat experience representing a majority of Sudanese. For instance, there is representation of the women, representation for youth, and also there is diversity represented in the cabinet. So it's widely accepted by people, and they expect that the holdup would bring a better choices.
So the cabinet represents a cross-section of Sudan. Talk to me about the women, because earlier in the week we heard that the foreign minister was going to be a woman. What else can you tell us?
Yes, actually, there is five women out of 18 ministers. They are so qualified women in different ages. For instance, the Minister of Higher Education and the Minister of Youth and Sport and the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So women, it's not only representation by the numbers, but how sensitive the ministers that they won in the formation of the Ministers' Council. Yes, this issue has been solved. Hamdok insisted to form the Ministers' Council to make sure that there is different representation of women, youth, and also the diversity of the country.
Every cabinet member's job is going to be very important to move Sudan forward. But I would say the most important job so far would be that of the finance minister, Ibrahim. What can you tell about him and the job ahead for him?
Yes, actually, Ibrahim al-Badawi is a well-known name for Sudanese. They were expecting him from the beginning because he's a technocrat, he's an experienced person, and he was very well-known that he was defiant for the change. So the first priority for finance minister is to enhance the living and the situation right now, because it's really crazy. In the same time, they should make use of the good political speech towards the different countries and towards international community. And one of the obstacles will be to remove Sudan from the blacklist and also to lift sanctions.
Earlier in the week, I spoke with Dr. Fari with the Sudanese Professionals Association. He focused on the issue of the sanctions. So I'm assuming that that's the feeling of most Sudanese people.
Exactly. Sudanese people right now, they raised very, very big hopes that sanctions would be lifted as long as the al-Bashir regime is not existed anymore. So they think there is no reason for U.S. sanctions.
Naba, thank you very much. We are always very happy to have you on Daybreak Africa.
Thank you, James. I'm happy too.
That was reporter Naba Mohideen speaking with us from Sudan's capital, Khartoum. The East Africa Healthcare Federation is meeting in a two-day conference in Kenya's capital, Nairobi, to strategize how best to improve health services in the region. Kenya's Health Cabinet Secretary, Cecily Kariuki, says Kenya and the region at large are focused on ensuring that citizens have access to better health care. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Attending the conference are a wide range of global leaders committed to transforming health system through best practices and innovation in health sector. Kenyan Health Cabinet Secretary Cecil Kariuki, speaking during the official opening of the conference, said that the non-qualified personnel in health sector are partly responsible for poor health services in most hospitals across East African region.
It is true we've had cases where patients went to seek attention from non-qualified, if you will, practitioners. And this has been recorded over the last few months. In response, what we did was to actually do a re-inspection of most of the facilities to confirm that we have the right HR with the right qualifications. Then indeed, we also know we have a few crooks operating and dispensing drugs, which actually are not authentic.
The region's healthcare federation is aiming at collaboration between the private sector and the government. A representative from South Sudan said that the conference will help them learn more about the new technological methods in health sector.
The event, and for the first time actually we brought in our members, senior members from the Ministry of Health, to come and actually attend and witness what's going on. The integration between the private and the public health sector, not only in South Sudan, but also how we can replicate it in South Sudan. Learn from Kenya, learn from Uganda, learn from all the other countries, and hope to try to rebuild our country as we come towards our peace within the next few months.
On the other hand, Tanzania's representative Dr. Shanogiro urged fellow doctors from the region to work together in improving the health sector.
Come together with same plans, same ideas, same strategies, make sure that we strengthen the unity within East Africa, but also talk about cross-border issues.
The East African health sector is struggling with tropical diseases such as malaria, sleeping sickness, leprosy, and others of parasitic origin. Other diseases including pneumonia, poliomyelitis, tuberculosis, and venereal diseases. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Moreno Jembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 6th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Wildlife activists from Africa are calling for international support to support world primates. Activists who attended the second African Primatology Association conference in Uganda this week say at least 62% of primates globally are under threat and may be extinct in a few years' time. Mugumi Davis Rakarinch reports from Kampala, Uganda.
The one-day conference brought primatology experts and conservationists from 30 African countries. Dr. Inza Kone is the head of African Primatology Society, which organized the conference. He said the main threat to primates in Africa is encroachment to primates' habitat.
There are many, many causes to habitat destruction, the major ones being agricultural expansion, urbanization, the development of infrastructures, mining, and so on. We are not saying that we are against development. We are saying that development can be compatible with wildlife conservation. We just have to think our development schemes differently to be in good harmony with nature conservation.
According to International Primatology Society, 60% of the world's 404 primate species are threatened with extinction. Kone said, unfortunately, primates in Africa are more likely to face extinction. For example, he said about 85% of primates in Madagascar are nearly or extinct. Ephraim Kamuntu, Uganda's Minister of Tourism, said primates, just like other wildlife, face both domestic and international threats. He said wild animals in Uganda face poaching as well as international wildlife traffickers. Kamon said the government has policies and regulations aimed at protecting wildlife. He said that Uganda has set aside 20% of the country's land for wildlife conservation. But that is not enough, according to Minister Kamuntu.
Illegal traders, they want ivory, they want king elephants, they want pangolins. All these things are real threats. This is, we are conserving for not only Ugandans, but for humanity. And for that reason, we call on human race, wherever it is. We call on international community, wherever it is, to support us in our conservation effort for us and the rest of the world.
Africa is home to a third of the world's primate species, according to African Primatology Society. Dr. Gladys Kalema Zikisoka, the deputy head of African Primatology Society, said Africans must seek for homegrown conservation solutions.
When we go to conferences in other countries, there are very few Africans, and yet they're talking about primates in Africa. We want that to change. We also want to be able to influence the global agenda for primate research and conservation. As Africans, not only waiting for people from other countries to tell us what to do, but us taking the lead.
Conservationists say for this to succeed, African governments must be ready to fund activities aimed at research and conservation of primates on the African continent. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
After the biggest cocaine bust in Guinea-Bissau's history this week, local authorities said the drugs were being trafficked to finance jihadist groups in Mali. Giles Yabi, founder of Wati, a West African think tank, tells Ricky Stryak about the links between regional drug trafficking and jihadist groups in the Sahel region.
But I think that it's always very difficult to substantiate the link between the drug trafficking networks and the jihadist groups. What is mentioned in the UN panel of experts report is that they is a specific person who has connection with the drug trafficking very clearly and who is suspected to use some of the revenue to fund terrorist groups, especially Al-Murabitun. But we cannot reduce the networks of drug trafficking to the ones that feed terrorist groups. It is a bit more complex than that because there are various actors and it is two different issues.
Can you talk a little bit about how you think it needs to be approached in this complexity? What the pitfalls might be just to approach it in such a simplistic manner, I guess.
The thing is that criminal economy has been part of Malian reality and of science, and this has been seriously amplified by cocaine trafficking involving networks from Latin America, Colombia, especially with other countries as well, which are the country of origin of the cocaine that's come to West Africa and the Sahel. The networks that are involved, that are heavily involved in drug trafficking, are not the same networks that are in the terrorist groups. But of course, when you have such economy, such illegal economy in the same place where you have other armed groups with more ideological motivations, one necessarily fits the other in the sense that most of the terrorist groups will find that it is an opportunity to get some money by protecting the convoys.
You mentioned a recent report from the UN panel of experts. What did you think was the most interesting finding?
Well, there are a lot of interesting things in the report, but it's not, you know, these are not things that are new, but it just shows very clearly how complex the situation is now and the fact that the peace process itself is tough, and it is very difficult to be optimistic about the implementation of a peace process because of these variety of actors. You have a lot of rivalries within the groups and then between the various groups, which are signatories to the peace agreements. And you have also some clear links between some actors who are supposed to be in the peace process and who are still dealing with the terrorist groups. And beyond that, you have the drug trafficking networks. And don't forget that beyond drug trafficking, you also have traffic of illicit goods, cigarettes, for example.
That was Jiao Jiabi, founder of WATI, a West African think tank. He was speaking to Ricky Stryker from Italy. Villagers around Minganga, a town in northern Cameroon, are protesting against Chinese gold miners for allegedly ruining their land. The villagers say they are poorer than before the Chinese arrived, with their farms and forests now destroyed. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Minganga.
These are cattle ranchers and farmers from villages around the northern Cameroon town of Minganga. Their song says that if nothing is done to save them from Chinese miners, famine may strike their locality in a not too distant future. Their spokesperson is 54-year-old cattle rancher Mamoudou Poro.
It's a Chinois qui nous fondu.
He says the miners destroy farms and do not even care to cover holes and trenches they dig on roads and cattle ranches before leaving. He says they want the Chinese to build the roads they destroyed and fill the trenches they dug, give them electricity and at least a school and a market before leaving. Until 2014, Minganga and surrounding villages cultivated maize, beans, groundnuts, and producing cattle for markets in Cameroon, Nigeria, and the Central African Republic. Then, some 300 new mining sites producing gold, zinc, nickel, and other materials were discovered in the region. Among the explorers were Chinese companies. More than 100 of the company's miners work in and around Minganga. They use caterpillar tractors and equipment that clean stones and sift soil, allowing them to detect gold faster than locals who use manual tools. Locals are paid about $2 per day to work at the Chinese mining sites. Cameroon's Minister of Mines, Gabriel Dododoke, says the complaints of the villagers are legitimate. He says he has asked the companies to respect the terms of their contracts with the government.
Les populations riveraines n'en bénéficient pas encore, tel qu'on pourrait attendre.
He says the population suffers as a result of environmental degradation and does not benefit as expected because their mineral resources are exploited in a disorganized manner. Officials with the Chining Mining Company in Maiganga declined to be interviewed about the allegations. However, company official Hu Long said the firm has assisted communities by providing aid to hospitals and building or refurbishing schools when solicited. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Maiganga, Northern Cameroon.
It's 25 past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with results from the African qualifying matches for the FIFA World Cup Qatar 2022. Somalia stunned Zimbabwe 1-0 in the first round, first leg match on Thursday afternoon. It was the Ocean Stars' first victory in their history in World Cup qualifying. Anwar Sidali Shakunda was the hero. Elsewhere, Ramadan Agabs scored a hat-trick to ensure Sudan grabbed a comfortable 3-1 away win over Chad in N'Djamena. Meanwhile, Rwanda proved too strong for Seychelles, who succumbed to a 3-0 defeat at the Stade Lunete in Victoria. The Pirates of Seychelles will be hoping to overturn the deficit in the second leg match, which is set to take place in Kigali on Tuesday. 28 teams will be involved in the first round in knockout contest where ties are played over two legs on a home and away basis. The 14 winners will go into the group stage to join the continent's 26 ranked teams. Staying with football news, Madagascar have become the second team in the last 3 days to pull out of an international friendly against South Africa over concerns around the deadly riots and xenophobic attacks that have shaken the country. Zambia were originally due to host South Africa in Lusaka on Saturday, but pulled out of the march in protest on Tuesday, citing security concerns following the violent attacks on foreign-owned shops in Johannesburg and Pretoria. Bafana midfielder Bongani Zungu have appealed to his fellow South Africans to stop the current attacks on foreign nationals.
As for me and some of the guys, we play overseas with foreigners in other countries, you know, it's sad, you know, to see what's going on in the country. And also we've got friends in our teams there in Europe, you know, they ask us questions, you know, what's going on, bro, you know, like you're killing our brothers and, you know, and it's quite sad.
In athletics news, world marathon record holder Eliud Kipchoge has said he will be aiming to break his own world record of 2 hours and 25 seconds when he will be taking part in this year's INEOS 159 challenge in Vienna, Austria this October. However, the marathon bigwig will not be defending his Berlin marathon since his major target is on the much anticipated run.
Well, I am expecting actually to inspire more than 3 billion people in the whole world. So the pacemakers are coming from all the continents from the whole world. This is to show that we are not only Kenyans that we are running there, but we are human beings on this world.
And finally, Rwandan women cricket team will be looking to maintain their 100% record in the ongoing friendly series against Nigeria when the two sides meet in the third game at the Gahanga Stadium later today. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. South Africa has begun assessing the toll of this week's anti-immigrant violence, which, according to authorities, has claimed 10 lives, injured scores more, incited fear, hobbled business activity, and strained relations with other African countries. In a televised speech on Thursday, President Cyril Ramaphosa denounced the attacks that began Sunday. That is it for this Friday, September 6th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. We have hundreds of reporters gathering the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 17 UTC and 22:30 UTC. We're also available online at voanews.com.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the biggest threat to President Yoweri Museveni's re-election in 2021 may be a 37-year-old musician. The future of Uganda on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.